From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The hardwood cabinet of Dr. Calipari seems a bit more bare after number one Kentucky's loss to unranked South Carolina this week. Ahead on Only a Game, Pat Forde's review of that scary movie. Also a conversation with the PBA's first ever female champion, Kelly Kulick. And the Milwaukee Bucks need you, assuming you don't mind standing and screaming for 3 hours or so at home games. Also ahead, the clatter and chatter of the little and not-so-little cross-country skiers of the Bill Koch Youth Ski League.
Order prevails, but when the race starts, it looks chaotic again. And, you know, as long as they finish with a smile on their face, it's all good.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Well, Kansas has been very good, and likewise Kansas State, and Syracuse has come on strong, and Villanova's great, and if Gonzaga hasn't been as bright as in the past, and if Connecticut has not assembled their best cast, well, March is still a month away, the days of high renown, so Duke could still move up a bit, and Texas could move down. In order to determine whether any of what I've just said about the present and future of various men's college basketball teams makes any sense, I'll call for the assistance of Pat Forde, who writes about the game for ESPN.com. Pat, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Bill. Always happy to be here and hear your verse. It wouldn't be winter, it wouldn't be college basketball without a little poetry from you.
Well, you're kind to refer to it as poetry. Let's start with the upset of the week, which saw unranked South Carolina defeat number one ranked Kentucky. Did anybody see that coming?
Absolutely not. No, I think a lot of Kentucky fans were trying to decide, A, if this team was going to go undefeated or not, and B, if it was the greatest team in the history of college basketball. Might have been a little bit premature there. Unbelievable performance by 5'9" Devin Downey of South Carolina, who may be the best midget scorer since Calvin Murphy, which goes back, you know, 40 years or so. And a bit of a reality check for Kentucky. This is a young team that had kind of played down to the level of its competition a bunch, and probably something that they needed to have happen to them.
Speaking of matters involving John Calipari, the coach of that Kentucky team, or not involving John Calipari because he always seems to run away from said matters, University of Memphis officials met behind closed doors with the NCAA's Infractions Appeals Committee in order to argue that the committee used faulty reasoning when it erased 38 wins during the 2007-2008 season due to Derrick Rose's fraudulent SAT exam. What are the chances that plea for leniency will be heard?
Not real good, I don't think, Bill. I mean, I think the NCAA is a bit miffed that they're even pushing the issue. There was a statement that came out a few months ago when it became clear that Memphis was going to appeal that basically said, from NCAA enforcement and the Committee on Infractions, you know, we could have slammed you harder then. I can't believe you're coming back in front of us, was the paraphrase of that.
Kansas, number two in the current rankings. Will the Jayhawks jump up a notch on Monday when the new rankings come out?
Yeah, I think they will. Now, they've got to, you know, win a very tough game tonight at Kansas State, Manhattan, Kansas, what they call the Octagon of Doom, the kind of eight-sided Bramlage Coliseum there. That'll be a very stiff test, but, you know, I do think Kansas is the best team in the country. I think most people thought that in November. A lot of experience, a lot of talent, a lot of athleticism on that team, and they're starting to play extremely well. They just destroyed a pretty good Missouri team on Monday night. They seem to be hitting on all cylinders.
Pat, it seems a little odd to me to look at the standings and see that North Carolina isn't even in the top 25. I can't imagine there's been a whole lot of sunshine illuminating Chapel Hill these days.
I don't think so, especially when you look and see Duke in the top 10. You know, that's kind of the double whammy for North Carolina fans. And, you know, I think we had probably become overly conditioned to Roy Williams reloading in rapid fashion after great teams, but it's caught up with them this time. They have a five-man freshman class, and nobody's calling this one the Fab Five because they are not performing up to expectations. A lot of talented guys, a lot of, you know, the quote-unquote five-star recruits, but they're just not playing very well.
Only Game producer Doug Tribou has threatened to try out for yet another pro basketball league unless you and I discuss Syracuse at this point. Currently the number four team in the nation, so you do it. Discuss.
Biggest surprise in college basketball, I think. I didn't expect anything from this team, but they've had addition by subtraction, as is sometimes the case in basketball, where you have some talented guys who really weren't terribly interested in listening to what the coach had to say. And the coach is going to be a Hall of, you know, he's a Hall of Fame guy. Jim Boeheim, he's won a championship, but Eric Diebendorf, Paul Harris, and to a lesser degree, Johnny Flynn are the unindicted co-conspirators, I guess you would say, in the tuning out of the coaches last year that probably kept that team from keeping it, from meeting its potential. They added a spectacular transfer from Iowa State, Wesley Johnson, and they're playing great basketball. I think that they're a national championship threat, and Jim Boeheim's my coach of the year at this point.
Pat, what other teams, surprising or otherwise, should we be looking out for as the season winds its way toward March?
Wisconsin, I think, was, as usual, undervalued. They're picked seventh every year or so in the Big Ten, and they're always top two or three. They gave Purdue a great game on the road Thursday night, and they're a handful to take care of every single night out. On the disappointment side, you mentioned North Carolina. Connecticut, I think, also would be in that boat. They've got, I think it's four of those, you know, quote-unquote five-star recruits on in the starting lineup, and not seeing much out of them. Obviously, Jim Calhoun's been out with the ongoing health issues that he has, but kind of expected more from the Huskies this season as well. And I think you can probably look at the SEC and say Tennessee hasn't, and Mississippi State both were ranked coming into the year and haven't really lived up to that billing either.
How can you say you expected more from the Huskies? They're undefeated. Wait a minute. That's the women's team.
Yeah. They might be able to step on the court and beat the men the way the men are going and the way the women are going at this point.
Pat, there will be 14 games today featuring some of the nation's top 25 men's teams. I'm rooting for the streaking Vanderbilts to hand Kentucky a second straight loss. Which games will you be watching?
Do you want to bring about civic unrest in the state of Kentucky? Do you think they can handle two losses in 1 week, Bill? Oh, my gosh. I mean, close the bridges, cordon off all the prescription meds, everything there. That would be scary. But, that's going to be a really interesting game. I want to see how Kentucky bounces back from that. And Vanderbilt's sneaky good. They really are. And then I'm going to be tonight at Kansas State. I'm looking forward to that. I haven't been in the Little Apple since 1986. I watched Bill Buckner boot the ground ball in a bar in Aggieville. It's the kind of the downtown, if you will pardon that expression, in Manhattan, Kansas.
You know, I think maybe there was a rule on only a game that we would never again allow mention of Bill Buckner's booted ground ball. So you've broken that rule.
I apologize. I hope
terrible.
It doesn't get me thrown off the show.
Pat Forde's 40-yard dash column appears on the ESPN website. He joins me from time to time to talk men's hoops. Thanks, Pat.
Thank you, Bill. Stay warm.
Many Milwaukee sports fans have been knocked on their backsides by the economy, leaving the Milwaukee Bucks searching for ways to put said backsides into the seats of their home arena. The small market Bucks may have found a recession-proof solution. As Wisconsin Public Radio's Kirk Carapeza reports, the NBA team's Australian-born 7-foot center is footing the bill for dozens of fans short on cash but loud of lung.
On a recent Wednesday night in Milwaukee, the Bucks and Toronto Raptors tip off before most of the 12,000 fans expected to be in attendance have even taken their seats. But as Bucks center Andrew Bogut posts up beneath the hoop and scores the game's first 2 points, the fans in section 212 go to work.
Andrew Bogut! Andrew Bogut!
This is Squad 6, a 100-member fan club named for Bogut's uniform number and for being the so-called sixth man. Bogut himself has paid for all 100 season tickets, with the one condition that the seat holders will stand and cheer from tip-off to the final buzzer.
Seven, six, five, four.
Squad 6 members wear green and red Bucks jerseys, wigs, cowboy hats, and sombreros. They constantly blow plastic horns, wave Australian flags, and bang drums. Their organized chanting reaches a crescendo near the end of the third quarter as Bogut and the Bucks try to make a comeback. Bogut played in front of much larger and rowdier crowds in his hometown of Melbourne, Australia. In 2005, the Milwaukee Bucks selected him as the first overall pick in the NBA draft. Since then, he's been disappointed with the anemic attendance at the Bradley Center. Bogut admits people may be staying away because the Bucks haven't made the playoffs in his first four seasons.
Obviously, when you're winning, more fans come. We haven't really had a winning season, but it's tough in a small market. It is an expensive ticket to get. A small market here in Milwaukee is very tough to get the arena full on a Monday or a Wednesday night.
The Bucks' average attendance dipped about 10% last season due to the recession. During the offseason, Bogut bought 100 lower-level season tickets and told the Bucks' front office to hold tryouts in order to find the most die-hard Bucks fans.
And I was actually very surprised how few people there were. There were about 20 of us for the initial audition.
Gary Huff is a mutual fund manager from Milwaukee. He decided to try out for Squad 6 because he was short on cash to spend on his favorite basketball team.
I was a little nervous. I actually brought my children with me, and I just went for it. And
can you tell me what you did?
Okay, it was a little rap. It was Bogut with us, slam dunk, red, 4-3. May I get my Bucks playoff tickets right now, please? You can't beat them. You can't beat them. Beat them. You can't beat them. You can't beat them, Milwaukee Bucks. Got the rookie Jennings.
Huff made the cut. So did Zach Grimm of Milwaukee. Like most members of the group, Grimm is a 20-something who couldn't otherwise afford Bucks season tickets. He says the Squad 6 experience changes the whole dynamic of being a fan.
No longer are you just a bystander and a professional observer. You're part of it now. You're one of the guys yelling. You're on the Jumbotron. You're representing the Milwaukee Bucks. You're representing Andrew Bogut.
There's no question that every league in America and every team is dealing with a disconnect.
Rick Burden is a sports management professor at Syracuse University. He says Bogut's generous gesture will instill local pride in Milwaukee at a time when many fans are coping with wage cuts, furloughs, and layoffs.
In a lot of cases, the gap between what a player earns and what the average guy on the street earns has become massive. I think what Andrew is doing is essentially trying to break down that gap and give people who may be economically hurting right now a chance to continue to support their team.
Back at the Bradley Center, Bogut fouls out, but not before scoring 27 points and pulling down 12 rebounds. The Bucks hang on to beat the Raptors 113-107, improving their home record to 12-7. Walking off the court, Bogut turns and points to Squad 6 in Section 212. Gary Huff, the Rapping Mutual Fund manager, points right back.
I don't think any other player in the league has done what he's done as far as wanting people to come and support his team and willing to come out of his own pocket to allow them to do so.
Icing his feet in the locker room after the game, Bogut says he always makes a point to recognize the members of Squad 6.
You know, I'm doing them a favor, obviously, with tickets, but, you know, they're still doing us a favor by coming here and cheering and doing all those good things.
Bogut won't say how much the Bucks are taking out of his paycheck to cover the price of the tickets. Whatever it costs, he says reviving the atmosphere at their home games has been more than worth it. For Only a Game, I'm Kirk Carapeza in Milwaukee.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The oldest Japanese athlete competing at the Winter Olympics in Vancouver will be Kazuhiro Koshi, who is 45, and he said this week that he is single-minded in his approach to his event, the skeleton. "I'm in it to win it," Mr. Koshi told Japanese reporters. "All I'm thinking of is the gold medal." Mr. Koshi, who has won four consecutive Japanese national skeleton titles since 1998, has been working especially hard on his mechanics at the top of the chute. "I wanted to make sure I don't lose any ground to the younger sliders at the start," he said. Mr. Koshi, who has shrugged off charges that he should have retired, said this week, "I'll show you all what an old man can do. You wait." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the Stanley Cup lets its hair down. But first, in 2006, Only a Game's Greg Eklund profiled bowler Kelly Kulick, who had recently become the first woman to earn a tour exemption from the Professional Bowlers Association. Today, Kulick is still breaking new ground. On Sunday, at the Tournament of Champions in Las Vegas, She became the first female bowler to win a PBA Tour title, and she joins me now. Kelly, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
The Tournament of Champions is one of the PBA's four majors. You beat Chris Barnes by 70 pins in the tournament final. At what point did you realize you were going to win one of the sport's most prestigious events?
I knew in the ninth frame getting up that if I struck, I pretty much shut him out. But I think I was in so much disbelief, I sat down in my chair and I kept adding up the score in my head. And then one point where, if you watch the show, I just kind of smiled because I finally added the score correctly and I knew that I finally won.
How have the men on the tour reacted to your success and to this particular tournament?
Most of the men prior to even making the show were very complimentary. They were asking me if I was comfortable, if everything was good, if I was prepared to go block to block because I was doing as well as I was. And then a few of them stayed behind specifically just to watch me bowl on the show. And I think most of them know that this is going to be great for the sport of bowling. And they were all were generally respectful and really good gentlemen.
Tell me a little bit about why you think it's going to be great for the sport of bowling.
Not just bowling fans tuned in this past Sunday. Corporate America, the entire world tuned in, and you can result by that is how it happened on Google right after the tournament was over, how often I was Googled. But everybody told me, I mean, I've heard stories along the way saying, you know, oh, I stopped, I was flipping through the stations. People in restaurants stopped eating because they were watching history being made. So this is going to have an impact on the sport by either bringing in more sponsorships, bringing in a broader fan base, and having more viewership to increase the ratings on Sundays. But really, the ultimate goal is to develop something for the women, either a continuation of the women's series of bowling and adding more events, or really even the future of our own women's tour.
Well, it strikes me that it may also inspire some number of young women to say, who needs a women's tour? We're going to go beat the men.
And that's probably true. Right now, there's less than a handful of us that do compete against the men, and not even on a full-time basis. I don't want to go against the men every week. I mean, they're just that good. Now, obviously, I've gotten better as a player. I'm getting stronger and stronger. My mental game is stronger, and I physically can keep up. But it's not to take anything away from the women, but I feel we should have our own platform to bowl on.
The women's tour, of course, has struggled to survive. What is the state of women's professional bowling right now?
Currently, we just have the women's series, which is only made up of seven events. I'd love to see it expand, but bowling itself, not just the women, even the men are on a downslope. And I've kind of said this all along, it's just we needed a spark, and I'm hoping that I provided the spark that's going to turn into a blazing fire.
You grew up in Union, New Jersey, I understand. How did you fall in love with bowling?
Really at a young age. My grandfather, you know, and I bowled when I was younger because I had two older sisters that were always out shopping. I grew up watching the ABC broadcasts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Chris Schenkel commentating and watching these gentlemen. So that's where the passion came. I just grew up watching it on Saturday afternoons.
Kelly, I don't want our listeners to feel that you are only a bowler because you have distinguished yourself in all sorts of ways. Tell me a little bit about how you ended up appearing in a Spider-Man comic book.
Back at a tour event in Pennsylvania, I met a young lady, didn't know who she was, introduced myself, and I helped her a little bit out in the lanes. And lo and behold, her father was Peter David. He was the writer of Your Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man. So the year I did make the men's tour, yeah, he approached me up in Long Island where he lives, and he said, I'd like to put you in a comic book. So I kind of had to do a double take, like, excuse me, comic book bowling? And we talked, we tied in my dad's body shop. Next thing you know, when I won the Queens, it's being added into the list of comic books. And I told him, I said, and I told this to everybody, I said, my only request is that I fly through the air and you make me a size 6.
So, Kelly Kulick, bowler / superhero.
Yeah.
I love it. Nor is that the end of your list of skills. Our senior producer, Gary Wallach, was recently in a fender bender. Happily, he was unharmed, but do you think he could help out in terms of his car?
Absolutely. I can guesstimate at things. My father's a true estimator. Yeah, I can work on cars a little bit. Basically, simple stuff. I change my own oil. I rotate my own tires. I'll take off bumpers and fenders and kind of put them back together. I still work in my dad's shop, but right now it's really clerical work. I just keep the books for him because I do travel so much. So not so much are the days where I'm actually working on vehicles, but I do have the experience.
In 2006, you were frequently called a pioneer in the sport of bowling. Do you feel like you're still a pioneer, or are you accepted to the extent that that's not an appropriate designation any longer?
I feel like I've been put on this earth for a special reason. You know, bowling is a sport I've been raised to do, just love to do. So if I can be the pioneer of women's bowling and bring it back and the way Billie Jean United, you know, ignited tennis, then I'll be happy to do it. I just want the same opportunities for everybody, and I just want to continue to be able to bowl, doing what I love until my body no longer allows me to do it or I lose the passion for it.
Kelly Kulick is a member of the Professional Bowlers Association, and on Sunday she won the PBA's 45th Tournament of Champions, becoming the first woman to do so. Kelly, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome. Thanks again for having me on the show.
Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud. He's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread? Take a look.
In the introduction to his new book, Then Wayne Said to Mario, subtitled The Best Stanley Cup Stories Ever Told, Kevin Allen maintains that since 1892, ice hockey's greatest players have regarded the Stanley Cup with, quote, deep adoration. Then Mr. Allen proceeds to present a number of stories that belie that contention spectacularly. What else would explain how the cup once ended up in a ditch at the side of the highway or in various swimming pools or filled with chicken wings? Joining me now to discuss same from WDET in Detroit is Kevin Allen. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Elsewhere in the introduction that I've just mentioned, you write that, quote, tradition demands that at public gatherings the Stanley Cup must be treated with a reverence and dignity that would usually be reserved for religious artifacts. How does the league go about ensuring that this will be the case?
Well, it's interesting. The reason why I wrote this book is I've always loved sort of the mixed reaction and feelings that players have about the Stanley Cup.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, there is a religious reverence to it. You know, if they have not won the cup, they won't be pictured with the cup. They won't touch the cup. It's almost viewed as a vision quest. you know, you work on it your entire career trying to win that cup. It is an overwhelming desire to win it, and the cup itself weighs about 34 pounds, and yet I've had players tell me that even though you know, most of them can bench press 250 or 300 pounds, that the weight seems staggering after it's over because their knees are weak and their arms are weak.
Mm.
And I know Dallas Drake, you know, who waited 17 years to win the cup with Detroit, told me that he was quivering when he tried to raise it. On the other hand, when they do win it, they're allowed to let their hair down with the cup, and they will do almost anything with that cup in the name of celebrating. There have been many different materials and items and things that have been placed in that cup through the years.
Well, we'll get to some of those stories, but the league does have a guy who sort of chaperones the cup, and he has to wear white gloves and everything, right?
Well, absolutely. You know, when they bring it on the ice, it's always where they're wearing white gloves, and it's always, you know, shined, and at the end of each a summer after the players have toured with it, it goes back to the silversmith who not only engraves the winners' names but also, you know, repairs the cup. And what a lot of people don't realize is there are actually two Stanley Cups. There is a replica Stanley Cup. And when I tell this story, fans generally believe, well, the one that the players party with must not be the original. But that's not true. In 1995, Commissioner Gary Bettman decreed that, you know, the quest to win the cup is too arduous to give them a replica. And when you go to the Hall of Fame in Toronto in the summertime, when the players have the cup, what the fans see is the replica.
Well, as you say, some of the most enjoyable stories in your book involve occasions where the Stanley Cup was abused, mislaid, and dented or otherwise damaged. Have you a favorite among those stories?
Well, I sure do, and it goes back to the celebration in 1992 when the Penguins had won, and they all gathered at Mary Lemieux's house for a celebration. And at that point, the party was rather tame till about 3 in the morning when Phil Bork, no relation to Ray Bork, stood up on a waterfall that Mario had near his pool, an artificial waterfall, and pushed the cup up like he was King Kong. It was over his head, and much to the chagrin of everyone around, he hurled it in the pool. Now, that was good fun, and everyone had a laugh until they realized that it formed a suction on the bottom of the pool, and it took 3.5 hours for the players to... They essentially had to form diving teams because it formed right in the suction on the bottom. And the next day, if you look at pictures of the parade and the celebration with the cup, Players are always holding it rather gingerly because they were afraid that one good yank and the cup was going to come off. But I think, again, that sort of shows the sort of contradiction because, you know, the cup is revered. It really is. And yet, on the other hand, once you win it, you're entitled then to, rock the house with it.
I don't know which of the various indignities suffered by the cup was most inglorious, but would you say doing service as the breakfast dish for a horse would be right up there?
Well, absolutely, though Eddie Olczyk, who is pictured in the famed photo that shows him feeding a thoroughbred, has insisted, and he did insist in for my book, that that was a staged event and that the horse never actually ate out of the cup. But saying all that, so what if he did? I mean, this is, we've had a monkey in the Stanley Cup. It's been filled with Dairy Queen ice cream. It's been filled with every liquid known to man. It's been a bait bucket on fishing for expedition. The only thing that's ever been turned down that I'm aware of is that a player who has not been named has asked to take it skydiving, and the Hall of Fame said no to that. And they've also decreed that it can no longer, and I say no longer because it's already been there, in strip clubs and gambling institutions. It's not allowed to go in there. And what's interesting is I think it says a lot about a player and what they choose to do with the cup. And, you know, Pat Verbeek, for example, took it to Mass. He was a very religious man, and he just thought he wanted to merge his religion with his other religion, and he did it there. Almost every player, though, that I interviewed always takes it back to where it all began, the local hockey rink.
I think it's remarkable that the player who wanted to take the cup skydiving asked permission.
Well, you got to do that because, you do have the keeper of the cup, and those guys never sleep.
They follow you everywhere.
They follow you everywhere, and, they're sort of the bodyguard for the cup. And believe it or not, even though there are all these rules that are sort of floating out there about no one should raise the cup unless they've won it, and you can only be handed the cup by someone who has won the cup, most of the keepers, have their own standards. As Walt Newbrand said to me, and he's a keeper of the cup, if Nick Lidstrom wants, his wife to hold the cup and she walks over and picks it up, who am I to say I didn't win the cup, Nick did? And I find that, refreshing.
It's perhaps appropriate to conclude this discussion with a mention of current superstar Sidney Crosby, who was photographed sleeping with the Stanley Cup after the Penguins won it in 2009. Did anybody else sleep with the cup before there were cell phones around to so conveniently make a record of it?
The first that I'm aware of is Brian Trache, who slept with it, obviously, in the 1980s. I know Steve Yzerman did with Detroit as well. But the cell phone photo age has upped the ante, and players are all aware of that. Because within 15 hours of the Penguins winning the cup and Crosby sleeping with it, it was all over the internet, including photos of the cup being back in Mary Lemieux's pool, where it shouldn't have been mm-hmm. because they don't really want it in the pool anymore. But I think players are well aware of that, and they live with that now every day. But I know I talked to Sid about it, and he did say that, you're going to have to be cognizant of that as you move forward because, you don't want to come across as being too irreverent, even though that's, part of the history of the Stanley Cup.
Kevin Allen is the author of Then Wayne Said to Mario, the best Stanley Cup stories ever told. It's published by Triumph. He joined me from WDET in Detroit. Kevin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
And it was May the 10th, 1970, the Bruins versus the Blues. 29 years of frustration, 3 decades paying dues. The score was tied in sudden death. A single goal would win the cup given by Lord Stanley to the NHL champion.
You're listening to Only a Game. In my conversation with Charlie Pierce last week, Charlie said he hoped the Vikings would not make it to the Super Bowl because he was tired of stories about Minnesota quarterback Brett Favre. Joe Kelly, who listens to Only a Game on WIAA in Cedar, Michigan, was unhappy with that. I have been troubled since late in the summer with the single-minded negative coverage of Brett Favre, he wrote. Favre performed at a high level throughout the season and deserves to be credited with that accomplishment. Ian O'Neill, who hears the program on WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, emailed to take issue with my commentary about Mark McGwire in last week's show. please, 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 he wrote, tell me your small piece on Mark McGwire was not sarcasm. Just say it ain't so. Sorry, Mr. O'Neill, it was. Baseball survived exclusionary racist rules long denied by the commissioner and owners. It has survived collusion by management and lockouts and gambling scandals, and it would have bounced back from its attendance slump 2 decades ago without the chemically enhanced home runs of McGwire and Sammy Sosa. Doug Trabue's story in last week's program about Dave Cummings, the man attempting to sink a million free throws to raise $1 million to help veterans and their families, provoked a listener named Donna to leave this comment on our website. Dave, you are an inspiration and a reminder to us all that we should be devoting some part of our lives to easing the burden and suffering of others. Among the other listeners responding to that story was Paige Oristano, who wrote, Dave, you have no idea how far your kindness will travel. And Abbott, who wrote, though I totally do not support the wars or how we got into them, what you are doing is so cool. Thank you for providing a way for those of us who support the troops to contribute to their welfare as they return. Last week's program also featured my conversation with the fabled two Chinese characters about the two Chinese women tearing up the tennis circuit. This moved Stephen Charles Brown to visit our Facebook page and write, two female Chinese players making it to the semis in Australia is a compelling feat, athletically and culturally. True enough, though Serena Williams and Justine Annan achieved the more compelling feats, and Williams won. If you're moved to comment on something you hear on the program, you can follow us at facebook.com/onlyagameradio. We're also on Twitter at onlyagameradio, or you can visit onlyagame.org and type away in the section marked comments. You can also leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
Follow the strong along, make life a happy song. Let's take a trip to Melbourne. There's lots to do and fro. A welcome waits for you. So let's take a trip to Melbourne.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The hard time Kevin T. Singer has been serving in Wisconsin's Waupun prison recently got harder. Mr. Singer had filed a federal lawsuit contending that when prison authorities banned him from playing Dungeons and Dragons, they violated his free speech and due process rights. Prison officials had reasoned that the game promoted gang-related activity because Mr. Singer was part of a team and that he was a threat to prison security. On Monday, the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the prison policy, ruling that, quote, punishment is a fundamental aspect of imprisonment. The trifling warlord is said to be outraged. Neither the dwarf fighter, the halfling rogue, nor the half-elf cleric could be reached for comment. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, having fun while competing on skis with a guy who knows a bunch about both. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
After his team, the Minnesota Vikings, failed to gain a spot in the Super Bowl, Brett Favre, 40, announced that returning for another season was, quote, highly unlikely. Did you cringe at his failure to say something definitive?
Yes, I think the doubling up on the adverbs is a really bad sign here. Also, apparently he's going to discuss his future with his family. Don't you think they're sick of talking about it, too? You know, it's February. Oh, Dad's going to talk about going back to football again. Can I rake the leaves? Can I go out mow the lawn? Every year we talk about Dad quitting his job.
Former Arizona Cardinals quarterback Kurt Warner, 38, announced his retirement yesterday for the first and presumably only time. Warner's time in the NFL has been notable for its ups and downs. He went to 3 Super Bowls. He threw for 32,000 yards and 208 touchdowns. That's a pretty decent career, wouldn't you say?
It's a terrific career, and I think he makes more sense than Brett Favre does. Kurt Warner's had some concussion problems. It's good that he's walking away. He made himself into a Hall of Fame quarterback, I believe.
Seven members of the Indianapolis Colts and seven members of the New Orleans Saints have been called to Miami a few days early for Sunday's Pro Bowl. The NFL sees their attendance as vital, even though they might otherwise be, preparing for another game to be played the following week. Some people are apparently annoyed by this. Couldn't have seen this one coming, could you?
Well, nobody wants to go to the Pro Bowl. The Pro Bowl is perhaps outside of the National Hockey League All-Star Game. The Pro Bowl is probably the most useless exercise on the sports calendar. Now they've decided to make it count by putting it on the Sunday before the Super Bowl and making people play in it, and all they're going to do is stand around and play essentially flag football. If I were either of the two coaches in the Super Bowl, I'd be furious right now.
The Super Bowl itself will occur a week from tomorrow, and so far the greatest pregame controversy has involved a television ad scheduled to run on that day, and as far as I can tell, nobody has seen the ad yet. It's said to star Florida quarterback Tim Tebow and his mother, and it's sponsored by Focus on the Family. Do we know any more about it than that?
See, being sponsored by Focus on the Family is what those of us who play poker call a tell.
Mm-hmm.
It is going to be an anti-abortion ad. The CBS is now turning its back on 20 years of refusing to accept quote-unquote advocacy ads. While they're perfectly willing to buy the time, let's not all pretend that CBS isn't taking a stand on one side of this issue right here.
Washington Wizards Gilbert Arenas and Javaris Crittenden have both been suspended by NBA Commissioner David Stern for the remainder of the season. Each man was armed in the Wizards locker room one night last month. Are you surprised by the severity of this punishment?
No, and I'm very happy to see that the NBA has given them both the same punishment rather than giving the superstar one and the minor player another in either direction. I mean, punishing a superstar to quote-unquote send a message just because the guy happens to be a superstar, it would not be fair. And at the same time, punishing the superstar more lightly than you punish the reserve player would be unfair either. At the very least, the punishments are consistent.
This week, the New Jersey Nets won a basketball game.
Woo-hoo!
And it was an important one since they avoided posting the worst record after 44 games in NBA history. And guess which team they beat?
They beat the Clippers. You know why? Because nobody likes the Clippers, not even God.
There is a little YouTube video of Clippers bloopers, and it makes it look like this game was fixed.
Well, it's not just bloopers. If you look at the Clippers, poor Blake Griffin, you get drafted by the Clippers, you break your leg almost instantly.
Elsewhere in professional basketball, Kentucky coach John Calipari got a call from President Obama late Tuesday afternoon, which may or may not explain why Kentucky lost for the first time this season, just a few hours later. What do you think?
He's had a tough couple of weeks, hasn't he, the president? I mean, this is really bad. Now the Kentucky people are going to hate him because they're going to blame him for jinxing them. Kentucky looked really young for the first time this year against South Carolina. They really looked baffled as to why they were behind. And while, you know, John Wall made another play that makes the whole rule of him not being in the NBA look idiotic, to get them close was a tough road game, and they looked a little confused.
Does this mark the right time to trot out that old cliche, it's better for them that they lose now and find their way with the tournament on the horizon?
College basketball, who knows? I mean, they have to play so many games at this point. You know, that argument makes a little bit of sense when in terms of an NFL schedule, and there are only 16 games, but this one, no, it doesn't make any sense.
In hockey news, Peter Chiarelli, the general manager of the Boston Bruins, announced on Wednesday that head coach Claude Julien's job was safe. So he'll be fired in, what, a week, 10 days?
Well, he ought not to be. This is just stupid. I mean, even if you accept the fact that the Bruins overachieved last year, which I do, a lot of guys had career years, their top three centermen haven't been healthy in a month and a half. You could bring Toe Blake back from the dead and he wouldn't be able to coach this team to much better than they're doing now. I mean, the idea that this is even buzzing around is a bad sign for the Bruins organization.
In tennis action down under, Roger Federer will face Andy Murray in the final at the Australian Open. Federer is going for his 16th Grand Slam title. Murray is hoping for the first Grand Slam title for a British man in 74 years. How's that for David versus Goliath?
Why can't the British teach their children how to play tennis, basically? on the bright side, however, for our friends across the pond, Andy Murray is one of only four players who have a career lifetime winning record against Roger Federer. He's 4-2 since he lost to Federer in the 2008 United States Open final. So this might be worth watching, actually. And it's hard to believe that it's been that long since a British man won a title.
It certainly is. All right, this week, Phil Mickelson, Jim Furyk, and Rocco Mediate became the most recent pro golfers to offer their opinions about when Tiger Woods will return to the tour. Are you ready to join me in supporting a moratorium on asking golfers to weigh in on that question?
Well, I think that pretty soon some golfer is going to pick up the pitcher of complimentary water and hurl it into the press gathering, which may kick off a moratorium all on its own. Phil said that he and his wife have had, quote, limited communication with the Woods family. I don't want to tip off Phil, but there's been limited communication between the members of the Woods family recently. Jim Furyk says that he thinks Tiger Woods will be back for the Masters. I think that's insane. The Masters people believe that, like, women in general are too much of a nuisance to have around. Can you imagine them putting up with, you know, rows of British tabloid reporters on the street across the street from the main gate to Augusta National or skulking through the Magnolia?
A Masters like no other before. Women's pro soccer took a hit this week, Charlie, as the league announced that last year's runner-up, the Los Angeles Soul, will fold and their players, including World Player of the Year Marta, will be dispersed to the other teams on Thursday. What's it going to take for L.A. to hold on to a football team?
Any kind of football
team.
Exactly. Maybe people should start looking at the fact that maybe there's too much to do in L.A. for professional sports. Maybe all professional sports should move out of L.A.
And finally, Charlie, a little quiz for you to wrap things up. The sport in which competitors have recently suffered a bruised lung, a broken finger, and a concussion is A, football, B, soccer, C, professional wrestling, D, pillow fighting.
Let's see. It's the last item on our list, isn't it?
Sports.
Then I would guess sports. No, I would guess pillow fighting.
And you would be correct.
This is really great. They have a league in Toronto. Most you can make, by the way, is $100 a bout, so don't get into this for the money. Get into this for the love. But apparently, it's 4 years old, and they train. The women in this league train in an old coffin factory in Toronto, which I assume has lots of pillows lying around.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Sports!
If you'd like to leave a comment about something you heard on Only a Game, please visit our website, onlyagame.org.
So you can use either like the edge, like this part, or the flat part.
And then all over if you run out, like when you're skiing, the coaches always carry around wax, so you'll be able to put on some more.
Zoe and Max, veteran members of the Bill Koch Ski League, know the importance of the right wax to optimum performance on the cross-country ski trails. Several weeks ago, at a Sunday morning team practice at the Weston Ski Center, a little west of Boston, Zoe, who is 13, not only helped some of the younger skiers prepare for their lesson, she explained how she'd come by her expertise.
Everyone thinks of Eastern Mass, which is our team, as flatlanders, because in Vermont there are hills and stuff, but all of our coaches are like scientists, so we have really intense waxes, and everyone thinks we're like losers because of that, but it's fun, it's really fun.
Actually, this particular day was probably less fun than some for Zoe and her fellow cross-country skiers because they weren't racing. The first hour of their time on the snow was spent in drills and technical work, after which there was time for games, but no stopwatches, no ribbons. According to Bill Koch, the Olympic silver medalist after whom the Cross Country Ski League was named several decades ago, the de-emphasis of competition is intentional. In fact, Koch made it a condition when he lent the clubs in Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and New York his name.
I said yes, contingent upon the whole idea that it's just fun and participatory for all levels of kids, that it's not serious racing, if you will, not getting into the Little League syndrome. So, you know, at the end of the year, that's why we call our final event the festival instead of a championship. And we do some racing, but we also do lots of other fun stuff, too.
The parents at the Weston Ski Center have absorbed Bill Koch's message. John LaChance has two children in the program. As a coach, he especially enjoys keeping his athletes in the dark.
One of the things the kids really love is we do these nighttime skis, and we have them bring in headlamps. And when we have conditions like this, where there's really good snow in the Boston area, natural snow, the golf course here has extensive trails. And one of the trails is a bridge that goes across the river. And especially for the younger kids, they just love being out there, especially when we start talking about wolves and bears and They get pretty nervous, but
I bet they stay close together on the trail on those occasions.
They do. Sometimes I feel a little guilty as a coach of the group of 9-year-olds, and I'm telling them these stories about wolves, and finally one little boy goes, "Are there really wolves out here?" And I'm thinking, "Oh, he's not going to sleep tonight. I'm going to get a call from a parent."
Trying to find where the power cooperation is going to be so I can gather those kids.
The talk of wolves, bears, and festivals notwithstanding, 2 weeks later, the members of the Eastern Massachusetts chapter of the Bill Koch Ski League have gathered to race. The next day, we'll see temperatures climb into the 50s. The ski trails will be slick with rain. But on this sunny Sunday morning, conditions are perfect.
Francesca, do you want hand warmers, Rudy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, okay, a little cold. Francesca's concerned mom is Ann Chelly from Belmont, Massachusetts. She and her family fell in love with the ski program their first day on the course.
When we came out here, it was this beautiful February morning, and the sun was shining, and everybody was tinkling their little bells, and people were skiing around, and it really had a nice feeling to the community of skiing in general.
Of course, the opportunity to get out in the sunshine of a winter day and listen to the bells wasn't the only attraction.
We're not kidding ourselves. I mean, our kids know who comes in first and who comes in second and what their times are and if they're doing better. But I really do think that there's a very nice community element.
That community's oldest kids are members of a group called Norway, since Norway's Olympians generally excel at cross-country skiing. Two of the groups made up of younger children are called France and Sweden, and the group containing the littlest skiers is called the Power Pops. That's because at some point the littlest kids said they no longer wanted to be called lollipops. Among them is Shay, a 7-year-old who's been skiing for a couple of years but began getting acquainted with the sport much earlier.
I started the team when I was 5, and then I think I started in like a little thing when I went around in like a little stroller thing when I was 2.
When the time comes for the sprint races to begin, Sue LaChance, who's preparing to record the times of the competitors, characterizes the scene, which looks to me like chaos.
Oh, chaos is part of the fun, actually. So, yes, order prevails, but when the race starts, it looks chaotic again. And, you know, as long as they finish with a smile on their face, it's all good.
Skiers, are you ready? On your marks. Get set, go! Go, 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 go! The next heat line up here, we have 4 skiers.
The challenge here is organization. By the time the competition is completed, 90 kids ranging in age from 6 to 13 will each have raced around the same course twice, which means that from 4 to 7 of them take off from the starting line every 2 minutes. The imp of the perverse led me to ask Sue LaChance how often there were collisions.
I better not put that on tape. None.
None that I saw, at least not on the course. Though when she was coaching some of the most accomplished skiers between heats, Dorothy Kern acknowledged to them the possibility.
Nobody fell, so you had all a good race. I want to do power, a little bit more power. Every step, you think like you're gaining another few inches, okay? Let's try that, okay? Let's just try it, right? There's nothing to lose.
Yeah.
It's only to win. Have fun, all right?
Kay.
Any questions?
Nope.
No.
Dorothy Kern played professional basketball in what used to be East Germany and cross-trained with cross-country skiing. Her daughter, Julia, skis in the club. When Kern takes a break from giving her charges tips on how to gain speed on the turns and explode over the tops of the hills, I mentioned to her that some of the younger kids seem to be having as much fun tossing snow at each other as they've had on skis.
Of course, that's where everybody started, and it's really the passion for the sport, what we want to bring over is this club, because these kids are all between 3 and 14 years old, and what's really important is that we don't overtrain the kids, that they have the passion and the joy of the sport, and then pick it up more when they go in high school and in college.
In 2 weeks, the world's best cross-country skiers will be competing at the Olympics in Vancouver. A few of the skiers from the U.S. are considered potential medal winners. That's a circumstance that delights the cross-country skier after whom the clubs around New England are named, Bill Koch.
I'd like to think that it would be a great boost for cross-country skiing, because I think that really, of anything I've ever done in my life, activity-wise, nothing is finer. I like to say that the more people that cross-country ski, the better off the world will be, and I truly do believe that.
It'll be at least the 2014 Games before anybody currently sliding around the track at the Westin Ski Center in a Bill Koch League bib competes for the U.S., maybe more like 2018. Maybe some of the hopefuls will be watching this winter's competition on television, though if the weather at home is cold and dry, it's more likely they'll be out skiing. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Tyler Murray. We had help this week from Alice Trajano at WDET in Detroit, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, learn more about our weekly music selections, or view our photo galleries, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. To share your opinions about stories you've heard on Only a Game and to get behind-the-scenes information about the show, you can visit our Facebook and Twitter pages. Username, Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from PBA champion Kelly Kulick, who acknowledges she's considering going up against the men again, but this time as an equestrian.
My friend and I, we've kind of created a bucket list, and horseback riding is one of them, but I don't know if I could wear those tight slacks and that little cap.
Hold on a minute. Are you suggesting that those accessories are sillier than bowling shoes? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.